In the name of our mother, in the name of our brother Jesus, and in the energy of their spirit, greetings. I'm standing here this morning to take my turn in our congregation's series of responses to the question, but who do you say that I am? I believe that Jesus' mother taught him life-saving resilience in the face of public shame. He grew up with his paternity in doubt in a community where that was devastating. Mary taught him to practice the presence of God so successfully that he eventually came to experience God as his papa. From his earliest social awareness, from the time he could tell what other people were thinking about him, he knew what it was like to be considered marginal by those who considered themselves moral and clucked their tongues and said, "Who is his daddy?" Jesus was known and loved by God regardless of how others regarded him. I believe it was this real connection to his creator, a connection that was not routed through any approval or shaming from God's own people. This connection to God that was at the core of his soul. And I believe that my hope of salvation from more toxic forms of human community or individuality is for me to adopt a faith like his, a trust like his. I believe in the power of Jesus' Spirit to enable people, creatures, and other creations to experience the real presence of the creative spirit herself. One of the most important things to me about Jesus is that he was a preacher of mercy rather than sacrifice. Leviticus 19:2 called God's people to be holy in the way that God is holy. Jesus claimed to be living that out every day. But in what way is God holy? It's pretty clear from Leviticus that holiness is separation. Separation from the impure. But Jesus apparently asked, what really makes God God? Jesus had a profound inner connection with a loving creator whose love was not conditioned by whether people deserved it or not, whether they were pure or not. So Jesus' experience of God didn't match that of the some of the images of God in his scriptures. So this connection he had, this soul-deep conviction of God's love, not being conditioned by whether his community approved of him or not, is what empowered Jesus to redefine holiness, to redefine godness, godliness itself as compassion rather than as purity. So while shame and fear are the ground floor, the foundation, the starting point of God awareness for so many religiously serious people, the keepers of the Jesus traditions, by contrast, never represent him as believing that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, as it says in Proverbs. Jesus so radically means all the way to the roots, redefined godliness by means of his fellowship with sinners and outcasts around him, that Jesus' contemporaries considered him a threat to holiness. But Jesus went even further than that. He extended Leviticus 19:18 to forbid vengeance against national enemies, not just against neighbors. This made Jesus a traitor in the eyes of the morally motivated freedom fighters around him. Jesus' compassion was not just for lepers, but for tax collectors and for the children of Roman centurions, the enemies of his people and of his peasants. Who do I say that Jesus is? Many things. He may have been a flag burner. By the time he was born, the fig tree was a common metaphor for Israel. He is remembered by gospel writers as cursing a fig tree, symbolically, in the same week that he said the temple had become a den of nationalist freedom fighters instead of a house of prayer for all nations? If indeed he followed up the curse with a reference to the Temple Mount being thrown into the sea through the power of prayer, he could have expected an imminent betrayal by any disciple for whom God's sovereignty and national sovereignty were one and the same. I hear Jesus as a teacher of the oppressed. There's a real connection between his parables and preachings and his crucifixion between two other men who were tortured and sacrificed for the health of the Roman economy. He unmasked in his parables and in his solidarity with the poor around him. He took the masks off the pretensions of the oppressor class that was masquerading as protectors of the common people. And he taught the peasants to survive by living in community in the midst of a deadly process of privatization of natural resources. It was happening all through Palestine at that time under Roman direction. Jesus was an honest resident of Palestine who saw what he saw and said what he saw. His vocalized contrasts between the sovereignty of God and the collaboration of Herodians and other realists, as they would like to be called, made him a target of the forces of law and order. Anyone moral enough to be tough on crime could see why Jesus would have anti-Herod zealots among his disciples. Listen to the way he talked and to what he criticized. Jesus was intelligent enough to have been able to make a living, I believe, as possibly a bureaucrat or a plantation house chaplain somewhere. But he kept living as a peasant instead and refused to make the kind of living that predator humans consider to be respectable or a high standard of living. Jesus was the kind of criminally honest peasant who sees others making a killing and hears them saying that they're only making a living and says, there's a contradiction there. Jesus lived and spoke as though no human lives are disposable, as though no slave, no terminally ill person, no Pharisee, no centurion, no zealot, no child. Nobody should be viewed as disposable for the sake of some higher purpose. If you know the politics of the time, you knew why the zealots considered centurion lives to be disposable. You knew why the centurions considered zealot lives to be crucifiable. They all had their reasons, their visions of a better world. And there were human lives that needed to be sacrificed to get there. And Jesus' vision didn't fit with any of those. His vision and community organizing was politically serious and thus could not be tolerated. If he were merely a cynic or a social critic, he could have been tolerated and we would never have heard of him. But along with his political seriousness, he was as religiously serious as anyone around. I believe that Jesus was a Galilean shaman, what the people who raised me would refer to as a witch doctor, somebody who understands things, understands portions of the human soul and of human connections to Mother Earth that some of the rest of us have forgotten. I believe Jesus was an accomplished practitioner of indigenous spirituality. He was initiated by a desert-dwelling cousin known as John Baptizer, a man who dressed like Elijah and had learned how to live off the land, specifically wilderness land. I believe that Jesus lived as a native child of God, of Mary, and of Mother Earth. He was a native. His initiation by John included being birthed out of the watery womb of the earth. And that baptism was immediately followed by an experience of the Spirit coming down upon him in a way it hadn't before, and immediately the Spirit drove him away into a, find my line here, 40-day vision quest in the wilderness. It was there that his vocational identity was added to his childhood identity during a life-changing experience that is common to religious leaders of indigenous communities around the globe. I was educated in the context of a modern rationality which was formed during the expansion of European empires. Every sermon needs a parenthesis where you can fade out and then just come back for the conclusion. This is the parenthesis, okay? Check your phones, check the air temperature, decide whether or not you want to be here. I'll let you know when to tune back in. I was educated in the context of a modern rationality which was formed during the expansion of European empires that were nostalgic for Roman forms of slave and plantation-based international economy. My education taught me to label any forms of knowledge that I couldn't recognize as useful for subjugating the earth and its native tribes, any knowledge that couldn't assist in that as irrationality. The limited form of instrumental reason taught in my schools was labeled science. Now, in pre-modern times, science was simply a synonym for knowledge. It meant knowing things. Knowledge of all kinds. But that changed by the time of the European invasion of the Americas. Knowledges of intimacy with the earth, the kind of native knowledge that Jesus had, were not seen as merely useless by Puritans and Jesuits and Mennonites. Those kinds of knowledge were seen as demonic. Western Christians have been scientifically engineering the destruction of earth-friendly knowledge and of its practitioners who feel at home on the planet for many centuries now. So you see, my educated worldview trains me to think of all reality, including divine reality, as scientific. And if I can't explain it scientifically, it isn't allowed to happen. That's the voice of the master class right there. If I can't see it from where I'm standing, it's not real. There is only one reality and a very mathematical-brained God. And God and I share that reality comfortably along with Newton's other disciples. There is no room in the world I live in for the kind of life that Jesus' Palestinian neighbors watched him live and helped him live. So do you see why modern historical Jesus studies are so important, but so inadequate? Jesus' disciples watched him live out a career appropriate to his identity as a spirit-possessed healer until his life was cut short by Western forces intent on establishing a new world order in the Middle East. End parentheses. Jesus' contemporaries experienced him as having the kind of access to the mind of God that's appropriate to a spirit-possessed prophet. When he asked who people thought he was, you can tell by the responses that many assumed he was blessed to be possessed by an ancestral spirit, much as Elisha had been granted to receive the spirit of Elijah. The Jesus traditions recount the appearance of Moses and Elijah with Jesus on a mountain. My worldview, and most historical Jesus scholars that I read, require that experience of the transfiguration to be one of two things. Either pure myth, didn't happen, they made it all up to make Jesus look important decades later. Or it's a miracle that really happened the way the disciples described it. If I would have been there, I would have experienced it the same way, and therefore it's real, but it violates science. My ability to know what's going on in communities different from mine is similarly handicapped between these two opposites. When it comes to the treasured memory of Jesus practicing other arts, such as locating fish where industrious fishermen had missed them all night. I grew up among people who said water smelling is not scientific, so it's probably actually bad then. If we can't do it, it's probably actually not neutral. It's probably bad. Okay? I don't know what to think about the fact that the tradition says Jesus told them where those fish were. He carried out psychosomatic healings that don't map easily onto modern medical models. I don't have a formula that can tell me when Jesus really did something that doesn't happen in the portion of reality that my scientific lenses allow me to actually see, or when he did something that I would have understood if I were there, but would have described more scientifically than what his disciples did, who were pre-modern. They lived in a world where powerful men and women found food when nobody else could find food, found water, protected from enemies, communicated with animals. This was the kind of spirit-filled world they lived in. They weren't as alienated from nature as I was carefully trained to be. So the disciples and their Jesus stories are not dishonest. They use the word pictures most adequate to how they saw things and how they understood things when those things happened. I think that if Jesus were here today, he would recognize the same needs for healing and exorcism, that's the casting out of demons, that were present under the savage heel of the Roman provinces. One Native American or Indian evangelical Christian recently adapted the story of Jesus healing the demoniac in Mark chapter 5 by picturing a possessed woman on a U.S. Indian reservation this way. And here's his word picture. "Jesus, what are you doing here?" screamed a voice from within the woman. "You're the last person I'd expected to see here." The statement was followed with maniacal laughter. Looking deeply within the woman's eyes, Jesus said, "What is your name?"
"My name?"
asked the voice.
"What is my name?"
Remember in Mark 5, it was Legion, right? The name for the Roman occupying forces that the centurion managed. In this word picture, "My name is Cavalry, Infantry, Military Mega Complex. My name is Trading Company, Border Town Liquor Store, Multinational Corporation. My name is Proselytizing Missionary, Religious Order, Denominational Mission Board. We are many. We are organized. We are in control. Our intentions are always and only for the very best."
"Get out of her," Jesus said. With one last shriek, the evil spirits left the woman.
"Jesus," she said, "may I go with you? I want to become a Christian."
With a weary smile and a shake of his head, Jesus replied, "No, child, this is not my intent for you. Stay here with your own people and tell them what the Creator has done." Contrast that sermonic word picture with the experience of another Native American Christian who attempted to worship God by using Native dance in a Protestant church service. The white pastor's wife objected to that and offered to cast an Indian spirit out of her. Excuse me, cast an Indian spirit out of him. I got the quote wrong. Someone's trying to worship while honoring their own identity and their own history. And that was seen as demonic. In the 1980s, a Californian pastor with the group Gospel Outreach said of the U.S.-backed dictator's army in Guatemala, "The army doesn't massacre the Indians, it massacres demons, and Indians are demon-possessed. They are communists." And that was around the time, about exactly the time, as Pat Robertson was happily hosting that dictator of Guatemala on the 700 Club, and the Reagan administration made sure that arms shipments coincided with Christian church shipments of humanitarian aid to Guatemala, so it looked like all we're trying to do is help. Today, Jesus is panting for air and dying of thirst at our southern border. His pain is visible in the faces of children running for their lives from the U.S.-made Herods of Latin America. If you worship Jesus, you worship a victim of state terror who died the death, the kind of death designed not for citizens of the Roman Republic, but for its slaves and for anyone who protested against the mistreatment of the lower classes. What is it about our Christianity that prevents us from recognizing Jesus under our own barbed wire heels today? Well, have a close look at Luke 23:41. So it's line 4 in your
reading for today. Thief number two, fondly remembered by the pious as the good thief. He says, "And we indeed have been condemned justly, for we are getting what we deserve for our deeds. But this man, by contrast, has done nothing wrong." One of my teachers, Shelley Matthews, asks, "Who in the ancient world would agree with Luke that the criminals hanging next to Jesus deserve to die, that their deeds, unlike the deeds of Jesus, merit the obscene death of crucifixion? From what vantage point does a storyteller, in this case an evangelist, put into the mouth of a victim of crucifixion while he hangs from the cross the affirmation that his torture owes to a meritorious judicial process? Fear of God occurred in line three here. God's behind this whole judicial process. Who would think like that?" Well, one response on my part is that Luke was at pains to render his gospel and his sequel, the Book of Acts, safe for consumption by a literate elite. He had to make sure the gospel was palatable to the people who were going to go on running the empire. That was part of his agenda. But what is our excuse? Why do we still tend to agree with the centurion who, a few lines later, says, "Certainly this man was innocent," the centurion who had overseen the entire judicial lynching of all of the, or the end product of the entire process and the torture, which may have included gang rape, we don't know what all, but all kinds of gruesome torture. He singles out Jesus and says, "Oh, but he's different. Why have I all my life identified myself only with the man on the middle cross, as though the slaves or peasants next to him were somehow deserving of a kind of lynching that cultured Romans thought was impossible to administer to anyone who was anyone, let alone anyone who in today's world would pass as what we call white? Nobody would do that. It's the equivalent in their world of what we call white. It was just wrong." My teacher points out that scholarship on ancient crucifixion comes largely from scholars trained not to reflect on their social location as beneficiaries of empire, settler colonialism, and racial privilege. What if I am living on the mountain that a Jesus-inspired prayer would pick up and cast into the sea? I am not a dysfunctional member of my society and its imperial economy. I cannot devise a way of making a living for my family that does not benefit from uncountable bloodsheds past and present. When I remember Jesus, I remember him as a friend of undeserving enemies, centurions, and as a friend to me and my people. Jesus asked to be remembered in the breaking of bread and the sharing of wine. These rituals mean many things to many people, and for some people, these rituals have been so twisted from their initial meanings, they become oppressive, and I understand why people trying to recover from spiritual abuse would abstain. These rituals mean different things to me on different weeks. So I'm not telling you how to think about them now. I'm saying that for me, today, primarily, the bread and wine serve as reminders that I am the kind of person who feeds on the health and flesh of others on a weekly basis. People I have never met. Victims of my ability to have more than my share of the world's resources. I would rather not think about it in terms of bourgeois spirituality hobbies. Communion seems rather uncool and unproductive. It doesn't do anything for me, like we say, but I need it. It reminds me that God is more reliably present as my victim than as my Marvel comic book hero who will smash my enemy. It reminds me that to see Jesus now, I should be on the lookout for whose body is being broken now, whose water pollution is being rationalized or ignored by my economy now, which peasant's olive trees are being bulldozed by my empire's client states now. My understanding of communion reminds me that the God Jesus trusted in is still living and dying all around me, and that if I want to see God, I need to study my inherited blind spots. and listen to whoever is marginalized by the religious and imperial economies of today.